was the only one alive in her family. Everyone else had vanished, including her brother. All that remained was the memory of the harsh words she had uttered the last time she had seen him alive. That was when she made a life-changing decision. It doesn't matter who I meet. I will never speak to them in a manner that I regret later, because this meeting could be my last. She could have spent her life in defeat and remorse, but she made this simple decision which transformed her life phenomenally. She went on to live a rich and fulfilled life. The most horrific things in life can be a source of nourishment if you accept, I am responsible for the way I am right now. It is possible to transform the greatest adversity into a stepping stone for self-transformation if you take 100% responsibility for the way you are now. A brighter tomorrow is a possibility. But if you take no responsibility for the present, if you blame your parents, your friend, your husband, your wife, your colleagues for the way you are, you have forsaken your future even before it comes. You come into this world with nothing. You go empty-handed. The wealth of life lies only in how you have allowed its experiences to enrich you. Filth can blossom into the fragrance of a flower. Manure can transform itself into the sweetness of a mango. No adversity is an impediment if you are in a state of conscious response, no matter what the nature of the situation you are in. It can only enhance your experience of life if you allow it to. Resentment, anger, jealousy, pain, hurt, and depression are poisons that you drink, but expect someone else to die. Life does not work like that. Most people take lifetimes to understand this simple truth. Now that we have established what responsibility is, it is time to look at what it is not. Let us start by clearing up a few fundamental misconceptions. For one, many believe that taking responsibility compromises their freedom. This seems to be logically true on a simplistic level. Existentially, it is completely off the mark. Which is freedom? You have choices or you have none. Your logical mind tells you give up all responsibility and you will be free. But in your experience of life, the more you are able to respond to everything around you, the freer you are. The logical and experiential dimensions of life work in diametrically opposite ways. Logic is not without its uses, but it helps only to handle the material aspects of life. If you handle your entire life with logic alone, you will end up a mess. Secondly, people often confuse responsibility with reaction. We have already demonstrated earlier that there is a world of difference between the two. The first is born in awareness, the second in unawareness. The first is born in consciousness, the second in unconsciousness. The first is freedom, the second is enslavement. It is time to make yet another distinction. Responsibility is not reaction, but it is not action either. Responsibility and action belong to different dimensions. The ability to respond gives you the freedom to act. It also gives you the freedom not to act. It puts you in the driver's seat of your life. It empowers you to decide the nature and volume of action you want to undertake. Responsibility is not compulsive action. It offers you the whole choice of action. Can you act upon everything in the world today? No. But you can respond to everything in the world today. Action has to be judiciously performed, depending upon a careful analysis of resources, strength, capability, energy, situation. Your ability to act is always limited. but there are no limitations on your ability to respond. If you are willing, you can respond to just about everything. Just because you are responsible for your children, are you able to do everything for them? If you did everything for them, you would mess up their lives. Your sense of responsibility makes you do certain things for them and not do others. So responsibility does not mean unbridled action, far from it. How, you may ask, are you responsible for the violence and injustice in the world? How are you responsible for the war and the bloodshed, the atrocities against the marginal and the underprivileged all over the world? Certainly you are not to blame for any of it, but the moment you become conscious of any of these events, you do respond either in concern, love, care, hate, anger, indignation, or even action. It is just that this is often an unconscious reaction rather than a conscious response. If you make this ability to respond into a willing process, that marks the birth of a tremendous new possibility within you. Your inner genius begins to flower. Can you then respond to the moon? You can. Your body and life energy certainly do. When entire oceans rise in response to the cycles of the moon, do you think the water content in your own system doesn't rise as well? Maybe you're not an astronaut. Maybe you can never walk on the moon, but you can respond to the moon. In fact, you already do. You can just choose to do it willingly, consciously. And that brings us to the fourth misconception. Many think responsibility means capability. Wrong again. When it comes to action, capability could play a role. But when it comes to response, it is just a question of willingness. If you see someone dying on the street, are you responsible? If you are willing to respond, you will explore various options. If you are a doctor, you will try direct intervention. If you are not, you may call 911. Or if all this is being done by someone else, you will at least have concern in your heart. But if you think you are not responsible, you will just sit there like a stone, watching someone die before your eyes. Your ability to respond is the way you are. Only your ability to act is connected with the outside world. Responsibility is not about talking, thinking, or doing. Responsibility is about being. That's the way life is, not an independent, self-contained bubble, but a moment-to-moment dialogue with the universe. You don't have to work at making it that way. You just have to see it the way it is. Let us deepen the exploration. If responsibility is response ability, the capacity to be responsive to situations, let me ask you another question. Is your ability to respond limited or limitless? Are you capable of responding to a plant? You are. To a stranger on the street? You are. To the moon? You are. To the sun? To the stars? You are. To the whole cosmos, you are. In fact, as we have seen, every subatomic particle in your body is responding in a limitless way to the great dance of energies that is the cosmos. The only reason you are not experiencing the life process in all its majesty and profundity is your current state of mental resistance. Your psychological structure is a stone wall. If you are willing, every moment of your life can be a fantastic experience. Just the act of inhaling and exhaling can be a tremendous love affair. Why is the mind resisting this? Because it is crippled by its own limited logic, which says, taking responsibility for just two people already gives me a headache. If I take responsibility for the whole world, what will happen? I will crack up. Through millions of years of evolution, nature has caged you within certain boundaries. This is the human predicament, but the imprisonment is only on the level of biology. On the level of human consciousness, you are like a bird in a cage without a door, What a tragic irony. It is only out of long eons of habit that you are refusing to fly free. Life has left everything open for you. Existence has not blocked anything for anyone. If you are willing, you can access the whole universe. Someone said, "Knock and it shall open." You don't even have to knock because there is no door. It is open. You just have to walk through. That's all. This is the sole purpose of spiritual process. The life and work of every spiritual guide across history and across culture has been just this, to point out that the cage door does not exist. Whether you fly or choose to remain in the limitations of the cage, let that be a conscious choice. The possibility of ultimate freedom may seem deeply threatening to many. Yes, it is a threat, but only to your limitations. Do you want to live a life of voluntary self-imprisonment, limiting your responsibility to suffocate yourself on various levels, physically, intellectually, and emotionally? Unfortunately, this stifling of life is understood by people as safety, as security. Take the case of a seed. If the seed constantly tries to save itself, a new life is impossible. The seed goes through the tremendous struggle of losing what it believes is its identity, losing its safety and integrity, and becoming vulnerable in order to grow into a many-branched leafy tree, abundant in fruit and flower. But without that vulnerability, that voluntary openness to transformation, life wouldn't sprout. One of the biggest problems in the world today is loneliness. It is quite incredible. The planet is teeming with 7 billion people, but people are lonely. If someone enjoys being alone, that is no problem at all. But most people are suffering because of it. They are going through serious psychological problems as a consequence. If you are lonely, it is because you have chosen to become an island unto yourself. It doesn't have to be this way. "I am not responsible" makes you unwilling to get along with anyone, until you cannot even get along with yourself. It often comes to a point when you believe you are not even responsible for what is happening within yourself. What the mind forgets is, the ability to respond is the basis of life. If the ability is acknowledged willingly, you will become blissful. If it happens unwillingly, you will become miserable. Being responsible is taking ownership of your life. It means you have taken the first radical step to become a complete human being, fully conscious and fully human. In taking responsibility and beginning the journey towards conscious living, you are putting an end to the age-old patterns of assigning blame outward or heavenward. You have begun the greatest adventure life has to offer, the voyage inward. This notion of responsibility, as you might have noticed, seems to lead us seamlessly to another word remarkably similar in its implications, a word we know well, perhaps much too well, a much-used, much-abused four-letter word, love. You know the teachings, of course. All over the world, people have told you that love is the ultimate, love is supreme, love is divine, that we must love our neighbors, and so on. All wonderful teachings. But when you try to become loving, it is difficult and often ends up seeming pretentious. Have you noticed this? It seems easier not to love at all than try to become loving. But to be loving is simply this, a willingness to respond freely and openly. Right now, it may be limited to one or two people in your lives, but it is possible to extend this ability to embrace the entire world. Does it mean going out into the streets and hugging everyone? No, that would be crazy, not to mention irresponsible. As we have said, responsibility is not about action, but a way of being. Love is not something that you do. It is just the way you are. Right now, you have left one window in your life open for a few people. You did that because somewhere you understand that if you closed that window, you'd go mad. Your only options would be insanity or suicide. But there is another way to approach this. Does it mean opening another window or another door? Here's a more effective option. Why don't you just demolish the wall? Love has nothing to do with someone else. It is all about you. It is a way of being. It essentially means you have brought sweetness into your emotion. If a loved one travels to another country, would you still be able to love them? You would. If a loved one passes away, would you still be able to love them? You would. Even if a loved one is not physically with you anymore, you are still capable of being loving. So what is love then? It is just your own quality. You are using the other person as a key to open up what is already within you. Why are you fumbling with keys when there is no lock, when there is no door, when there is no wall? You create illusory walls, doors, and then create illusory keys. Then you fumble with the keys, and once you find the key, you're terrified of losing it. For most people, love is initially a joy, but after a while it becomes an anxiety. Why? Because this key has legs and has a will of its own. You can't keep it in your pocket or hang it around your neck. When you try to do that, two lives are heading straight for disaster. Once your joy is on self-start rather than push-start, you have upgraded your technology. You are no longer enslaved to an external source, whether a person or a situation. You are now capable of being loving and blissful without doing anything in particular, just sitting here, no matter how anyone in the outside world behaves. Once you experience this inner freedom, you will never experience insecurity in your life again. And anyway, when you are a truly blissful human being, everyone will naturally want to be around you. Blissfulness means life is happening in an exuberant manner, and that is all life seeks. So how does one upgrade one's inner technology? We will look at this at length in following chapters, but a fundamental step would be to recognize consciously just this. My ability to respond is limitless, but my ability to act is limited. I am 100% responsible for everything that I am and everything I am not. For my capabilities and my incapabilities. For my joys and my miseries. I am the one who determines the nature of my experience in this life and beyond. I am the maker of my life. Absolutely nothing is required. No reaction or action. No capability. Other than being aware of the basic fact that your responsibility is limitless. You could sit in one place and be aware of it. You could walk on the street and be aware of it. You could be working, cooking, or even lying in bed and be aware of it. Let me ask you another question. Whatever your religion or cultural background, what exactly do you mean when you use the word God? The forms, the names, the ideas are varied. But essentially, when you say God, you mean that which is responsible for everything in the universe. Suppose God said, "I will not be responsible for you." He is most definitely fired. The very word God signifies limitless responsibility. So responsibility is not a teaching in civics. It is the simplest and easiest way for you to express your own divinity. The whole effort of the spiritual process is to break the boundaries you have drawn for yourself. Experience the immensity that you are. The aim is to unshackle yourself from the limited identity you have forged as a result of your own ignorance and live the way the Creator made you, utterly blissful and infinitely responsible. After my experience on Chamundi Hill, one thing became clear to me. In life, there is no this and that. There is only this and this. This means everything is here and now. The access to everything is here and now. It lies only in one's ability to respond, in one's ability to experience and express the divine. There is no yes and no. There is just yes and yes. The choice is yours. You can either react to life with yes and no, which will mean a perpetual division of this existence, which is the basis of repetitive cycles of conflict and misery, or you can become one big yes to life. Limited responsibility is a way of drawing boundaries. What you think you are responsible for will be within your boundary. What you think you are not responsible for will be outside your boundary. But limitless responsibility extends itself way beyond your present level of understanding and perception. There is more, much more to life than you are aware of right now. Once you choose to become conscious of this simple fact, my ability to respond is limitless. Suddenly, life within you reorganizes itself in a completely different way. You move into higher and higher levels of freedom within yourself. Life is now a wonderful, accelerating journey of self-discovery. The outside world has seen its share of bloody revolutions. They were violent because there were some people who were willing to change and there were some who were unwilling. But in the inner life, there is only one kind of revolution and it is a silent one. It is about moving from unwillingness to willingness. The question is, do you want to be a full-time human being or a part-time human being? If you restrict your ability to respond, the scope and dimension of your experience will be unsurprising, predictable, limited, narrow. But to be an absolutely full-time human being is to be a constant, full-blooded response to everything. You don't have to do anything in particular. You just need to become a willing piece of life in this glorious living cosmos. Responsibility is not burdensome. Boundaries are burdensome. If you draw yourself a boundary, whether of ideology, caste, creed, race, or religion, you cannot move beyond it and you end up stuck for no reason at all. These boundaries only end up breeding fear, hatred, and anger. The bigger your boundary, the more burdensome it becomes. But if your responsibility is limitless, where is the boundary? No boundary, no burden. This is the turnaround in human consciousness that needs to take place. Once this happens, it is not that cosmos begins to happen your way. Instead, what you are becomes cosmic. This is not transcendence. This is homecoming. Sadhana. Don't simply believe what you are reading. The only way to find out whether something is true or untrue is to experiment with it. Stop the internal debate and simply put it to the test. The yogic path is not a path of inherited belief. It is a path of experiment. Here is a practical way to begin. When you have your next meal, do not talk to anyone around you. For the first 15 minutes, just be in active, conscious response to the food that you eat, the air that you breathe, and the water that you drink. As I have said earlier, your entire system is responding anyway. Just become conscious of it. This apple, this carrot, this piece of bread, don't take them lightly. If you do not eat for a couple of days, you won't think about God. you will only think about food. This is what is nourishing you, making your life right now. This is the very substance of your body. Respond to food absolutely, with total attention. This fruit, this egg, this bread, this vegetable, they are all a part of life themselves. But they are willing to become you. Would you be willing to do this for anyone? You are not willing to lose your identity and merge into anyone. You are not even willing to surrender your little finger for someone else. Momentarily, you surrender just a little, usually when you need something. Your love affairs are the product of very calculated surrender. But food, which is a life unto itself, gives itself up completely to become a part of you. Later, without even uttering a sentence aloud, take the simple idea. My responsibility is limitless. If I am willing, I can respond to everything, into the entire day. Be conscious of it until the last moment before you fall asleep and remind yourself of it the first thing when you wake up. If you sustain this awareness of your limitless nature for just one full minute, you will achieve tremendous transformation. A minute may seem very simple, but you will see it will take a certain level of application to arrive at this. Just 1 minute can elevate you to a different dimension of experience and function. Right now, your awareness is erratic. This moment you're aware, and the next moment you're gone. It is okay. Every hour, remind yourself, experiment with this awareness, allow it to deepen, and see what happens. Conscious response brings you to a profound and enduring state of connectedness with life. Not as an idea or an emotion, but life as life is. In this willing, active involvement with life, you are embraced by it, and the embrace takes you to the very source of creation. That is all it takes to touch the Creator. Just willingness, nothing else. And now, yoga. Patanjali Yoga Sutras, one of the most profound documents on the yogic sciences, begins with a strange line. And now, yoga. A great document on life starts with just half a sentence, why? This is because you arrive at yoga only when you realize that your desire is essentially for the limitless, and that absolutely nothing else will settle you. Every human being lives in a perpetual state of insufficiency. No matter who you are or what you have achieved, you still want a little more than what you have right now. This is human desire, but the fundamental desire within every human being is for boundless expansion. Most people are not aware of the nature of their longing. When their longing finds unconscious expression, we call this greed, conquest, ambition. When their longing finds conscious expression, we call this yoga. If you still believe that everything will be okay the moment you find a new girlfriend or boyfriend, get a raise, buy a new house or car, then it is not yet time for yoga. Once you have tried all these things and more, and clearly know that none of it will ever be enough, then you're ready. So now yoga. What exactly is yoga? If you were to close your eyes and conjure an image, it would probably be one of bodies twisted into impossible postures, bone-bending, muscle-knotting, teeth-gnashing contortionism. That, for many, is yoga. The trend is changing nowadays to some extent, and many yoga studios also impart breathing techniques and meditation processes. So for some people, the image of yoga might be one of serenely smiling faces, and perfect body seated effortlessly in lotus position, but none of that is what we mean when we talk of the science of yoga. Yoga is not a practice. It is not an exercise. It is not a technique. The images in popular consciousness point to a bowlderized form of yoga that has now pervaded the world. This is a travesty of a science of extraordinary grandeur and profundity that originated in the Indian subcontinent. The science of yoga is quite simply the science of being in perfect alignment, in absolute harmony, in complete sync with existence. The many fluctuations of the outside world have their impact on each one of us, but yoga is the science of creating inner situations exactly the way you want them. When you fine-tune yourself to such a point where everything functions beautifully within you, naturally the best of your abilities will flow out of you. You have surely noticed that when you are happy, you always function better. You seem to have an endless supply of energy. You can go on and on, even without eating or sleeping. Just a little happiness liberates you from your normal limitations of energy and capability. When your body and mind are in a relaxed state, you are also free of several nagging ailments. Let's say you go and sit in your office with a headache. A headache is not a major disease, but just the throbbing can take away a whole lot of your capability at work and your enthusiasm for the job, and perhaps for life itself. A simple headache can turn what is most precious to you into a source of vexation and even misery. This also works conversely. When your loved ones are irritated with you, they invariably feign a headache. But with the practice of yoga, your body and mind can be maintained at the highest possible level of capability and efficiency. And yet, yoga is not just a self-help tool for greater mental and physical efficiency and freedom from headaches. It is all that and much more. Modern science tells us that all of existence is just energy manifesting itself in different ways and in different forms. This means that the same energy that can sit here as a rock, can lie there as mud, can stand up as a tree, can run like a dog, or be here reading this book as you. So you're essentially a morsel of energy that is part of a much larger energy system of the universe. The cosmos is just one big organism. Your life is not independent of it. You cannot live without the world because there is a very deep moment-to-moment transaction between the two of you. Although everything in the universe is the same energy, it functions at different levels of capability in different forms. The same energy functions in one plant to create roses, in another plant it functions to create jasmine. With the same material with which people made earthen pots, we now make computers, cars, and even spacecrafts. It is the same material. We have just started using it for higher and higher possibilities. Essentially, natural evolution is a similar phenomena from the same material of this planet. What an incredible journey has been made from an amoeba to a human being. It is the same with our inner energies. Yoga is the technology of upgrading, activating, and refining these inner energies for the highest possibilities. Suddenly your capabilities reach a level of brilliance that you never imagined possible. An accidental and limited life turns near miraculous. But yoga performs an even deeper function than ensuring well-being at body, mind, and energy levels. Literally, yoga means union. When you are in yoga, it means that in your experience, everything has become one. This is the essence of the science. This is also its deepest aim. What is this union? What unites with what? Right now you're aware of someone called me and someone called other. This me and other can be extended to groups of people, communities, and nations, but fundamentally, me and other is the basis of conflict in the universe. The whole point of yoga is to bring you to an experience wherein, if you sit here, there is no such thing as you and me. It is all me or all you. Any process that helps you to reach this union is yoga. How can union be achieved? There are several ways, but let us start at the beginning with our ideas of what constitutes an individual. If I were to start telling you things you did not know, you would have a choice to believe or disbelieve me. Either way, you have only concretized your assumptions, whether positive or negative. This will only take you into flights of fanciful imagination. But the whole process of yoga is to take you step by step and stage by stage from the known into the unknown. It is 100% empirical science. It does not ask you to take anything on trust. It urges you to experiment every step of the way. So, let us look at what exactly you understand by the word myself. Right now, in your understanding, this you is constituted by your body, your mind, which includes your thoughts and emotions, and your energies. Your energies may not be in your experience currently, but you know them by inference. If your body and mind function as they do, there must be some kind of energy empowering them. These three realities, body, mind, energy, are what you know. They are also what you can work with. Yoga tells us that we are actually composed of five sheets or layers, or simply bodies. As there is a medical physiology, there is a yogic one as well. It leads us from gross to subtle levels of reality. Do you have to believe in it? No, but it is a useful place at which to start our exploration. Your fundamental area of work, however, is only with the realities that you're aware of. The first sheath or layer to which yoga draws your attention is the physical body, the annamaya kosha, or more literally, the food body. What you call the body right now is just an accumulated heap of food. It is the product of nourishment you have ingested over the years. That is how it gets its name. The second layer is manomaya kosha, or the mental body. Today doctors are talking a great deal about psychosomatic ailments. This means that what happens in the mind affects what happens in the body. This is because what you call mind is not just the brain. It is not located in any single part of human anatomy. Instead, every cell has its own intelligence. So there is an entire mental body, an entire anatomy of the mind. Whatever happens in the mental body happens in the physical body, and in turn, whatever happens in the physical body happens in the mental body. Every fluctuation on the level of the mind has a chemical reaction, and every chemical reaction in turn generates a fluctuation on the level of the mind. The physical and mental bodies are like your hardware and software. Hardware and software cannot do anything unless you plug into quality power. So the third layer of the self is the pranamaya kosha, or the energy body. If you keep your energy body in perfect balance and exuberance, there will be no disease in your physical or mental bodies. Today, there is scientific evidence to show that the impact of genetic memory on the human being is not absolute. Except the fundamental aspects of the DNA, everything can be changed, including the genetic trends of susceptibility to ailments. Infectious diseases happen because of external organisms, but chronic diseases are manufactured daily by human beings. When your energy body is in full vibrancy and proper balance, chronic diseases cannot exist in the body. I could introduce you to thousands of people who have gotten rid of their physical and psychological ailments just by doing certain simple yogic practices. These practices are not aimed at the disease. They are just aimed at bringing a certain harmony and vitality into the energy body. These are the three dimensions of the self you are aware of right now: the physical, the mental, the energetic. They are essentially physical in nature. Though each is more subtle than the preceding one, it is like a light bulb, electricity, and light. All these are physical. One you can hold in your hand, the other you can feel, the third takes a sensitive receptor, like the eye, to experience. But they are essentially physical, which is why you can experience them through your sense organs. However, there is a fourth layer called Vijnanamaya Kosha, or the etheric body. Jnana means knowledge. Vishesh Jnana means extraordinary knowledge, that which is beyond the sense perceptions. This is a transient state. It is neither physical nor non-physical. It is like a link between the two. It is not in your current level of experience, because your experience is limited to the five sense organs, which cannot perceive the non-physical. Those who report near-death experiences, or those who could have slipped accidentally into this state, such an experience occurs when, for some reason, people's physical, mental, and energy bodies have become feeble. If you learn to find conscious access to this dimension, there will be a quantum leap in your ability to know the cosmic phenomenon. There is also a fifth sheath, the Anandamaya Kosha, which is beyond the physical entirely. Ananda means bliss. It has nothing to do with the physical realms of life. A dimension that is beyond physical cannot be described or even defined. So yoga talks about it only in terms of experience. When we are in touch with that aspect beyond the physical, we become blissful. It is not that a bubble of bliss lies within your physical structure. It is just that when you access this indefinable dimension, it produces an overwhelming experience of bliss. But bliss is not a goal in itself. Once you touch this dimension of non-existence, blissfulness is guaranteed. In this state, you are no more an issue in your own life. When you are no more an issue, you can fearlessly explore the beyond. When you touch this dimension beyond definition, the impact of time and space is obliterated. This accounts for the many stories of yogis sitting unmoving for incredibly long periods of time. This is possible not because of physical endurance, but because in these states they are not available to the process of time. They have touched a dimension beyond all the contradictions of here and there, now and then, a limitless ocean of emptiness where there is neither bondage nor freedom, an existence beyond existence. Yoga does not ask you to work with anything other than what you know. It simply tells you that if the physical, mental, and energy bodies are perfectly aligned, you will find access to the bliss body. But your work, as we said before, is only with the first three bodies. When it comes to external realities, each human being is differently capable. What one does, the other may not be able to do. But when it comes to inner realities, all of us are equally capable. There is no guarantee that you will be able to sing, dance, climb a mountain, or make money merely because you want to. But making your inner life blissful is something that everyone is capable of. It cannot be denied to you if you are willing. Once you master certain basic yogic technologies for inner well-being, your journey through life becomes absolutely effortless. You are able to express yourself in your fullest potential, without any stress or strain. You can play with life whichever way you want, but life cannot leave a single scratch upon you. So to experience well-being, all you need is a certain mastery over these three dimensions of body, mind, and energy. Being successful in the world depends on your ability to harness these dimensions according to the needs of your life situations and the activity you want to perform. But yoga is also the science of aligning these three dimensions so that you reach the ultimate state of ecstatic union with life itself. How does one reach this ultimate union? Yoga tells us there are a few fundamental ways. If you employ your physical body to reach the ultimate union, we call this karma yoga or the yoga of action. If you employ your intelligence to reach your ultimate nature, we call it jnana yoga, yoga of intelligence. If you employ your emotions to reach your ultimate nature, we call this bhakti yoga, yoga of devotion. And if you use your energies to reach the supreme experience, we call this kriya yoga, yoga of transforming energies. Every human being is a unique combination of the same ingredients. All these aspects, karma, jnana, bhakti, kriya, have to function in an integrated way if one wants to get anywhere. If these four dimensions, body, mind, emotion, energy, don't walk together, you will be one big mess. Once it happened, four men were walking in the forest. The first was a jnana yogi. The second was a bhakti yogi. The third was a karma yogi, and the fourth was a kriya yogi. Usually these four people can never be together. The jnana yogi has total disdain for every other type of yoga. His is the yoga of the intellect, and typically an intellectual has complete disdain for everybody else, particularly these devotional types who look upward and chant God's name all the time. They look like a bunch of idiots to him. But a bhakti yogi, a devotee, thinks all this jnana, karma, kriya is a waste of time. He pities the others who don't see that all you need to do is know that God exists, hold his hand and walk in trust. All this mind-splitting philosophy, this bone-bending yoga is absurd to him. Then there is the karma yogi, the man of action. He thinks all the other types are just plain lazy. Their lives are pure self-indulgence. But the kriya yogi is the most disdainful of all. He laughs at everyone. Don't they know that existence is just energy? If you don't transform your energy, whether you long for God or for anything else, nothing is going to happen. There can be no transformation without transforming energies. These four people customarily cannot get along, but today they happen to be walking together in the forest. Suddenly a storm broke loose. It grew fierce. The rain started pouring down relentlessly. Drenched to the skin, the four yogis started running, looking desperately for shelter. The bhakti yogi, the devotion man, said, "There is an ancient temple in this direction. Let's go there." As a devotee, he was particularly familiar with the geography of temples. They ran in that direction. They came to an ancient temple. All the walls had crumbled long ago. Just the roof and four columns remained. They rushed into the temple, not out of any love for God, but just to escape the rain. There was a deity in the center. They ran toward it. The rain started lashing from every direction. There was no other place to go, so they moved closer and closer. Finally, there was no alternative. They just sat down and embraced the idol. The moment these four people hugged the idol, suddenly God appeared. In all their minds, the same question arose, why now? They wondered. We expounded so many subtle and arcane philosophies, worshipped at every possible sacred shrine, great and small, selflessly served so many people, did so much body-breaking penance, but you never showed up. Now when we are just escaping the rain, you turn up. Why? God said, at last you four idiots got together. Yoga is, quite simply, the science of bringing the four idiots together. Right now, for most people, these four dimensions are aligned in different directions. Your mind is thinking one way, your emotions pull you another way, your physical body another way, your energies another way. This makes you a potential calamity, a disaster in waiting. You are being hijacked. You are being pulled apart in four different ways. It is now time to plunge into the adventure of self-alignment, into the remarkable empirical system that is yoga, one that enables you to be both alchemist and experiment, subject and object at the same time. And so the next section of this book turns pragmatic. Having mapped the terrain, we now embark on a real journey, a conscious journey of self-discovery and self-reclamation. We will explore the nature and possibilities of the first three yogic layers or sheets, namely body, mind, which includes thought and emotion, and energy. It will also introduce you to strategies by which you can turn each of these layers into a tool for transformation, an instrument of knowing. The problem is that religious nuts around the world have exported everything that is beautiful about a human being to the other world. If you talk of love, they speak of divine love. If you talk of bliss, they speak of divine bliss. If you talk of peace, they speak of divine peace. We have forgotten that these are all human qualities. A human being is fully capable of joy, of love, of peace. Why do you want to export these to heaven? There is so much talk of God and heaven, mainly because human beings have not realized the immensity of being human. It is obvious that the very source of life is throbbing within you. The source of your life is also the source of every other life, the source of all creation. This dimension of intelligence or consciousness exists in every one of us. The deliverance of every human being lies in finding access to this deathless dimension, to be joyful and peaceful within yourself every moment of your life, to be able to perceive life beyond its physical limitations. These are not superhuman qualities. These are human possibilities. Yoga is not about being superhuman, but about realizing that being human is super.
Yogaratova, Bogaratova, Sangaratova, Sangavihina.
Inner Engineering, A Yogi's Guide to Joy. Continues with part two.
Ramate chittam yasya brahmani ramate chittam.
Part two. A note to the reader. The next part of the book grows more specific, taking you deeper into an exploration of the three fundamental sheets or layers of identity that every human being is conscious of. Accordingly, it is divided into three sections, body, mind, and energy. Within each section, the book seeks to extend your ideas of what constitutes the physical, the psychological, and the pranic or energetic. In the process, you may find some assumptions interrogated, some clichés punctured, some commonly used terms redefined, some unusual perspectives explored. But you are required to take nothing on faith. Yoga, as we have said before, asks you to experiment and encourages you to do so fearlessly. And so, this section oscillates between information and suggested practice and self-observation exercises. It concretizes concepts and suggests ways to implement ideas. In the process, you can find out for yourself whether these concepts are workable or if they are simply so much hot air. What is the best way to approach this section? You may not feel inclined to implement each of the exercises offered in the sadhana sections. That is absolutely fine. The reason for offering you a range of practices and tips is so that you can zero in on any that appeal to you. These steps are simply intended to help you make the transition from the page to the business of daily living, to offer you the freedom to test every hypothesis in the laboratory of your own life. This section aims at turning you from a passive reader, an armchair yogi, into a dynamic participant in the magic of a life consciously lived, freely chosen. It's time to roll up your preconceived notions and gear up for an uninhibited exploration of the incredible life that you are. Body, the ultimate machine. The most intimate part of physical creation for all of us is our own bodies. The physical body is the first gift of which we are aware. It is also the ultimate machine. Every other machine on the planet has come out of this. The yogic sciences, as I explained earlier, do not speak of the mind or the soul. Everything is just a body, whether it is a food body, a mind body, or energy body, an etheric body, or a bliss body. There is a deep wisdom in this approach. It does not allow us to escape into deluded psychological states or into flights of metaphysical abstraction. It grounds us firmly in the tangible, even as it leads us into subtler realms of physicality and gradually into the beyond. The physical body is designed and structured to function by itself without much of your intervention. You don't have to make the heart beat, the liver perform all its complex chemistry, or even try to breathe. Everything that is needed for your physical existence to manifest itself is happening on its own. The body is a pretty complete and self-contained instrument. If you are fascinated by machines, there isn't a better one. This is the most sophisticated piece of machinery on this planet. It embodies the highest level of mechanics, the highest level of electronics, the most sophisticated electrical circuitry you can imagine. Let us say you eat a banana this afternoon. By evening, this banana has become you. According to Charles Darwin, it took millions of years to make a monkey into a human being. But in just a few hours, you are capable of making a banana or a piece of bread into a human being. Obviously, the very source of creation is functioning within you. There is an intelligence at work within you, way beyond your logical mind, which can transform a bit of food into the highest piece of technological excellence. If you could achieve this transformation consciously instead of unconsciously, if you could bring even a drop of that intelligence into your daily life, you would live magically, not miserably. It is because he experienced the source of creation throbbing within him that the 12th century Indian mystic Basavanna famously called the body a moving temple. "My legs are pillars," he says in one of the well-known verses of South Indian mystical literature, "the body the shrine, a head a cupola of gold." Something there is that doesn't love a wall. It takes a certain amount of awareness for a person to see the limitations of this fantastic machinery. As a machine, the body is actually faultless. The only problem is it does not take you anywhere. It just springs out of the earth and falls back into the earth. Isn't that enough? If you look at it from the perspective of the body, it is quite enough. But somehow, a dimension beyond physicality has infused itself into this wonderful mechanism. This dimension is the very source of life. It is this dimension that truly makes us who we are. Life is one thing, but the source of life is another. In every creature, in every plant, in every seed, this source of life is at work. In a human being, this source of life is even more magnificently obvious. It is because of this that